What's up, everyone? It's James in post-production, as you know. Just wanted to thank you all for your patience with us as we've been getting back into the swing of podcasting. This episode you're about to listen to was recorded a little while ago on April 1st. We've got a couple more in the can, and although I'm about to travel for work, I'm going to be doing lots of preparation and note-taking for more content coming to you later this summer. So, hope you all are doing well. Thank you for being a fan of Compost Bin of History, and enjoy the show.
Drill, baby, drill.
Okay, are you ready?
For you to drill me?
A very Roman sentiment. Hail, Jared, and hail, listener. Welcome back to the Garden of the Glorious Future podcast, where we stick our gladiuses into degenerate ideas and slay them alongside our perfidious enemies. Tis I, Optimus James, joined by my co-consul.
The Roman word for Jared.
I'm going to call you Sextus Jared.
All right.
Since you were born in the sixth month.
For Sextus Jared, glory be, it is the first of the month, and that's the best fucking day, and everyone knows it, so try to change my mind.
Yeah, it's Calends Aprilis, a day blessed by Jupiter. So what a glorious day for us to make a podcast honoring our wonderful empire, which we support through our service and with our lives.
This is the best day I've had in 30 days, motherfucker.
Jared, you know, we're pretty virtuous around here. We're pious people. We respect, you know, the pantheon, the gods, and of course, our national heritage embodied by the wonderful Roman Empire.
And I don't know, man. I think these togas are pretty sick, too.
You know, as we have been, we've been reading our history of the weak and unvirtuous Emperor Claudius so that we might, you know, learn from his example and how to avoid the many pitfalls which became him in his crippledom.
In his what?
You know, because he was a cripple, right? Obviously, weak and unvirtuous. Because of his many moral shortcomings.
Ah, oh yeah. That's what I think. That's what I was raised to think, yes.
Well, before we do, let's check in with the progress of our many military campaigns. Specifically those going on right now in greater Syria and also the Scythian with our Scythian client state, where our funded forces, our mercenaries, are going up against the Sarmatians.
Well, we're in a virtuous place with dangerous neighbors, and you know sometimes you just got to protect your borders.
That's right. Yes. So this is from an Oriental news source. So. If there's a lot of bias in it, that's probably why. It's probably actually thinks that, you know, the people who live out there aren't just future slaves for our empire. So take this with a grain of salt.
This comes in from news from the Silk Road, eh?
Yeah, this is from Al Jazeera.
All right.
And this is, of course, also not just our war with the Sarmatians, but also the Parthians. Okay.
Of course, who could forget?
How could we? Out of our many glorious conquests.
Hey, man, that's how my uncle got his house. All right. So.
All right. The Roman-led coalition has been engaged in Syria for almost 8 years. Well, the Sarmatians intervened in the Syrian civil war in 2015, tipping the balance in the Syrian king's favor. Of course, the Sarmatians out of Moscow have since expanded their military facilities in Syria with the permanent air and naval bases, much to our consternation. Last week,
the Romans carried out multiple air attacks in Syria against what it said were Parthian-aligned armed groups, which the Pentagon blamed for a previous drone attack. U.S. officials said the attack by the armed group killed a Roman military contractor. Did I say U.S. officials? I meant Roman officials, excuse me. And wounded about a dozen legionaries at a coalition base in the northeast of the country near Hasake City. But then the pro-Parthian forces in Syria warned in an online statement signed by the Parthian Advisory Committee in Syria that they would respond to the Roman airstrikes on their positions. Now, what that means is that Roman military officials announced on Friday that the deployment of the George H.W. Bush carrier strike group would be extended after the drone attack by the Parthian-backed groups. And that decision means that the Roman strike group and its more than 5,000 legionaries, which are currently in the European command operational area, will not be returning home as scheduled. So these perfidious Parthians are going to keep our boys occupied over there in their capacity to respond to any stochastic provocation which may necessitate an imperial response.
Well, we've clearly pissed off Mars with all the decadence befuddling Rome.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll do much honor to Mars, the god of war, in our coming conflict with the Parthians, as which will surely happen through the necessity of history and the conquest of weaker men by greater ones.
Boy, I hope so. I don't know how I could wake up more angry in the morning.
I gotta say, this is too easy for me to do this. It makes me a little unsettled. All right, how about what's been going on with Tribune of the Plebs, Donald Maximus Trump? Have you heard about that?
Shouldn't have paid that girl.
Well, and that's the grand irony. All he did was pay a courtesan to have sex with him. He didn't even have to pay her. And yet the magistrates, funded by his senatorial allies, no doubt, or his senatorial enemies, no doubt, have decided that that is some sort of crime in a fit of pure ludicrousness and a total betrayal of our ancient values, going back to early consuls like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson.
Well, all I know is Trump cares about Roman citizens, and that's all I care about.
Well, he's had his inviolability stripped as Tribune of the Plebs, and surely this will mean some sort of new civil war conflict in the near
Shouldn't
future.
We all just be impressed and admire a man that has that much gold to spare on a frivolous pursuit?
That's a good point. That's a good point. That's an extremely Roman virtue. But here's why I'm optimistic about this, Sextus Jared. It's because I feel that by getting his tribuneship and inviolability back into the public eye with this obviously ludicrous case against him, this can only help Tribune of the Plebs Donald Maximus Trump in his upcoming consular election.
Well, it just proves how far Rome has fallen, you know?
Yes. I do know. That's a good point. Also, and this is quite distressing, Sextus Jared, it's come to my attention that an alternate dimensional version of our Roman Glorious Future podcast has indicated that Rome is not really a republic anymore. That rather, the senators serve only their own interests, and that even our glorious Emperor Brandon, is not actually the autocrat that we hoped he was, but rather merely a vessel for a conspiracy of the Praetorian Guard and the many wealthy families which run our society, and that the Republic has been dead for a long time. Can you believe that shit?
Jealousy, just punishing the most successful Romans.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that they're stuck in that crappy dimension, and we're over here in our glorious Roman dimension.
Here.
Awe, true to Caesar.
Awe, true to Caesar.
Well, do you want to follow up on anything there, Sextus Jared, or should we get into our reading of the histories?
I would say it speaks for itself.
Yes, and glory to Jupiter and Apollo. Truly, truly our primary deities of podcasting.
12 the virtuous ancestors of Rome.
Yes, all of our virtuous ancestors, whose names we bear with honor. All right, shall we, Jared?
I think we shall.
All right. It's I, Claudius, chapter 3. The name Livia is connected with the Latin word which means malignity. My grandmother was a consummate actress. In the outward purity of her conduct, the sharpness of her wit, and the graciousness of her manners deceived nearly everybody. But nobody really liked her. Malignity commands respect, not liking. She had a faculty for making ordinary, easygoing people feel acutely conscious in her presence of their intellectual and moral shortcomings. I must apologize for continuing to write about Livia, but it is unavoidable. Like all honest Roman histories, this is written from egg to apple.
See, you know what's funny about this? We just did our little skit or whatever. Good Americans now would be like, oh yeah, go ahead, just fucking blame everything on your grandma.
I prefer the thorough Roman method, which misses nothing, to that of Homer and the Greeks generally, who love to jump into the middle of things and then work backwards or forwards as they feel inclined. Yes, I have often had the notion of rewriting the story of Troy in Latin prose, for the benefit of our poorer citizens who cannot read Greek, beginning with the egg from which Helen was hatched, and continuing, chapter by chapter, to the apples eaten for dessert at the great feast in celebration of Ulysses' homecoming and victory over his wife's suitors. Where Homer is obscure or silent on any point, I would naturally draw from later poets, or from the earlier Dares, whose account, though full of poetical vagaries, seems to me more reliable than Homer's, because he actually took part in the war, first with the Trojans, then with the Greeks. I once saw a strange painting on the inside of an old cedar chest, which I came to believe was somewhere from northern Syria. The inscription in Greek was, "Poison is queen." And the face of Poison, though executed over 100 years before Livia's birth, was unmistakably the face of Livia. And in this context, I must write about Marcellus, the son of Octavia by a former husband. Augustus, who was devoted to Marcellus, this would be his nephew, had adopted him as his son, giving him administrative duties greatly in advance of his years, and had married him to his own daughter, Julia. The common opinion at Rome was that he intended to make Marcellus his heir. Livia did not oppose the adoption, and indeed seemed genuinely to welcome it as giving her greater facility for winning Marcellus's affection and confidence. Her devotion to him seemed beyond question. It was by her advice that Augustus advanced him so rapidly in rank, and Marcellus, who knew of this, was duly grateful to her. What do you think about the Queen of Poison, Jared?
I think it's pretty metal.
Yeah. Livia's motive in favoring Marcellus was thought by a few shrewd observers to be that of making Agrippa jealous. Agrippa was the most important man at Rome after Augustus.
Agrippa was a G.
A man of low birth. And we talked about Agrippa in our last episode. He was one of the boys, one of the bros, who wingmanned Augustus into the imperial seat.
We just like mentioned that he existed, didn't we?
Briefly, but Claudius will tell us more. Agrippa was the most important man at Rome after Augustus, a man of low birth, but Augustus's oldest friend and most successful general and admiral. Livia had always hitherto done her best to keep Agrippa's friendship for Augustus. He was ambitious, but only to a degree. He would never have presumed to contend for sovereignty with Augustus, whom he admired exceedingly, and wanted no greater glory than that of being his most trusted minister. He was, moreover, overconscious of his humble origin, and Livia, by playing the grand patrician lady, always had the whip hand of him. His importance to Livia and Augustus did not, however, lie only in his services, his loyalty and his popularity with the commons and the Senate. It was this. By a fiction which Livia herself had originally created, he was supposed to hold a watching brief for the nation on Augustus's political conduct. At the famous sham debate staged in the Senate after the overthrow of Antony between Augustus and his two friends, Agrippa and Maecenas, Agrippa's part had been that of counseling him against assuming sovereign power, only to let his objections be overruled by the arguments of Maecenas and the enthusiastic demands of the Senate. Agrippa had then declared that he would faithfully serve Augustus so long as the sovereignty was wholesome and no arbitrary tyranny. He was thenceforth popularly looked to and trusted as a buttress against possible encroachments of tyranny. And what Agrippa let pass, the nation let pass. It was now thought by these same shrewd observers that Livia was playing a very dangerous game in making Agrippa jealous of Marcellus, and events were watched with great interest. Perhaps her devotion to Marcellus was a sham, and her real intention was that Agrippa should be goaded into putting him out of the way. It was rumored that a devoted member of Agrippa's family had offered to pick a quarrel with Marcellus and kill him, but that Agrippa, though he was no less jealous than Livia had intended him to be, was too honorable to accept such a base suggestion. It was generally assumed that Augustus had made Marcellus his chief heir, and that Marcellus would not only inherit his immense wealth, but the monarchy, for how else can I write of it but as that, into the bargain. Agrippa therefore let it be known that while he was devoted to Augustus, and had never regretted his decision to support his authority, there was one thing that he would not permit as a patriotic citizen, and that was that the monarchy should become hereditary. But Marcellus was now almost as popular as Agrippa, and many young men of rank and family, to whom the question, monarchy or republic, seemed already an academic one, tried to ingratiate themselves with him, hoping for important honors from him when he succeeded Augustus. This general readiness to welcome a continuance of the monarchy seemed to please Livia, but she privately announced that, in the lamentable case of the death or incapacity of Augustus, the immediate conduct of state affairs, until such time as further arrangements could be made by decrees of the Senate, must be entrusted to hands more experienced than those of Marcellus. Yet Marcellus was such a favorite of Augustus that, though Livia's private announcements usually ended as public edicts, nobody paid much attention to her on this occasion, and more people courted Marcellus. The shrewd observers wondered how Livia would meet this new situation, but luck seemed to be with her. Augustus caught a slight chill, which took an unexpected turn, with fevers and vomiting. Livia prepared his food with her own hands during this illness, but his stomach was so delicate that he could keep nothing down. This is in BC 23. He was growing weaker and weaker, and felt at last that he was on the point of death. He had often been asked to name a successor, but had not done so for fear of the political consequences, and also because the thought of his own death was extremely distasteful to him. Now he felt... Go ahead.
I don't know. That's just funny. He really hated.
I mean, it's.
He really hated that he was dying. He's just like, fuck Rome.
So much so that he wouldn't even pick someone to take over.
Because he's not actually going to die, goddammit. If you pick somebody and you don't die, then you got a big problem on your hands.
Well, Augustus has kind of internalized his own bullshit at this point, right? Like, given where he's at and what he's done in his life, I think he's kind of thinks that he's a god as well.
Fucking like as, Jesus, you know, basically.
So many of the poor people. Yeah, yeah.
He's a minor deity that's walking around on Earth.
Right. So why would he die, right? The thought of his own death was extremely distasteful to him. Now he felt that it was his duty to name someone, and asked Livia to advise him. He said that sickness had robbed him of all power of judgment. He would choose whatever successor, within reason, she suggested. She made the decision for him, and he agreed to it. She then summoned to his bedside his fellow consul, the city magistrates, and certain representative senators and knights. He was too weak to say anything, but handed the consul a register of the naval and military forces, and a statement of the public revenues, and then beckoned to Agrippa, and gave him his signet ring, which was as much as to say that Agrippa was to succeed him, though with the close cooperation of the consuls. This came as a great surprise. Everyone had expected that Marcellus would be chosen. And from this moment, Augustus began, mysteriously, to recover. The fever abated, and his stomach accepted food. The credit for his cure went, however, not to Livia, who continued attending to him personally, but to a certain doctor called Musa, who had a harmless fad about cold lotions and cold potions.
Yeah, he made Mucinex. Right?
I think so, yeah. Augustus was so grateful to Musa for his supposed services that he gave him his own weight in gold pieces.
His supposed Musa. We got some anti-vaxxing going on here.
Augustus was so grateful to Musa for his supposed services that he gave him his own weight in gold pieces, which the Senate doubled. Musa was also, though a freedman, advanced to the rank of knight, which gave him the right to wear a gold ring and become a candidate for public office.
Oh, yeah, dude, the first fucking...
And still more extravagant degree. Dude.
He's like the first dude that's like getting ripped up into CEO by all the shareholders.
Oh, yeah. Or like one of those, you know, like personal doctors for an emperor who like does one good thing once and then just was like... lavishly praised, like Trump's doctor who like said he was like the healthiest guy on the planet. So Musa was also, though a freedman, advanced to the rank of
this
knight.
Guy is like fucking
a freedman means that he used to be a slave as well.
This guy is what internet bros thought that Martin Shkreli dude was going to turn into, like pharma bro turned
totally.
Bro turned noble.
And a still more extravagant decree was passed by the Senate, granting exemption from taxes to the whole medical profession.
Hell yeah, dude.
You know, one a big one for the doctors in Rome.
They had their blinged out chariots that they rode around town, running over sick children.
Just making business for themselves, yeah.
They also own the insurance company.
The Romans did come up with insurance. They were one of the first.
Well, they really liked having other people's things.
Marcellus was plainly mortified at not being declared Augustus's heir. He was very young, only in his 20th year. Augustus's previous favors had given him an exaggerated sense both of his talents and of his political importance. He tried to carry the matter off by being pointedly rude to Agrippa at a public banquet. Agrippa, with difficulty, kept his temper, but that there was no sequel to the incident encouraged Marcellus's supporters to believe that Agrippa was afraid of him. They even told each other that if Augustus did not change his mind within a year or two, Marcellus would usurp the imperial power. They grew so rowdy and boastful, Marcellus doing little to check them, that frequent clashes occurred between them and the party of Agrippa. Agrippa was most vexed by the insolence of this young puppy, as he called him. He who had borne most of the chief offices of state and fought a number of successful campaigns. But his vexation was mixed with alarm.
Young puppy, what he meant, or did he mean like small dog?
That's what he called Marcellus, just because he was inexperienced and young and hadn't done anything. But his vexation was mixed with alarm. The impression created by these incidents was that Marcellus and he were indecently wrangling as to who should wear Augustus's signet ring after he was dead. Agrippa was ready to make almost any sacrifice to avoid seeming to play such a part. Marcellus was the offended, and Agrippa wished to put the whole burden on him. He decided to withdraw from Rome. He went to Augustus and asked to be appointed governor of Syria. When Augustus asked him the reason for his unexpected request, he explained that he thought he could, in that capacity, drive a valuable bargain with the king of Parthia. He could persuade the king to return the regimental eagles and the prisoners captured from the Romans 30 years before in exchange for the king's son, whom Augustus was holding captive at Rome. Of course, those regimental eagles had been captured from Crassus on his Parthian campaign prior to the Pompey-Caesar conflict of the Civil Wars. He said nothing about his quarrel with Marcellus. Augustus, who had himself been greatly disturbed by it, torn between old friendship for Agrippa and an indulgent paternal love for Marcellus, did not allow himself to consider how generously Agrippa was behaving, for that would have been a confession of his own weakness, and so made no reference to the matter either. He granted Agrippa's request with alacrity, saying how important it was to get the eagles back, and the captives, if any of them were still alive after so long, and asked how soon he would be ready to start. Agrippa was hurt, misunderstanding his manner. He thought that Augustus wanted to get rid of him, really believing that he was quarreling with Marcellus about the succession. He thanked him for granting his request, coldly protested his loyalty and friendship, and said that he was ready to sail the following day. He did not go to Syria. He went no farther than the island of Lesbos, sending his lieutenants ahead to administer the province for him. He knew that his stay at Lesbos would be read as a sort of banishment, incurred because of Marcellus. He did not visit the province, because if he had done so, it would have given the Marcellans a handle against him. They would have said that he had gone to the east in order to gather an army together to march against Rome. But he flattered himself that Augustus would need his services before long, and fully believed that Marcellus was planning to usurp the monarchy. Lesbos was conveniently near Rome. He did not forget his commission. He opened negotiations through intermediaries with the king of Parthia, but did not expect them to conclude for a while. It takes a deal of time and patience to drive a good bargain with an eastern monarch. Marcellus was elected to a city magistracy, his first official appointment, and made the occasion for a magnificent display of public games. He not only tented the theaters themselves against sun and rain, and hung them with splendid tapestries, but made a gigantic multicolored marquee of the whole market palace. The effect was very gorgeous, particularly from the inside when the sun shone through. In this tent making, he used a fabulous amount of red, yellow, and green cloth, which, when the games were over, was cut up and distributed to the citizens for clothes and bed linen. Huge numbers of wild beasts were imported from Africa for the combats in the amphitheater, including many lions, and there was a fight between 50 German captives and an equal number of black warriors from Morocco. Augustus himself contributed lavishly towards the expenses, and so did Octavia, as Marcellus's mother. When Octavia appeared in the ceremonial procession, she was greeted with such resounding applause that Livia could hardly restrain tears of anger and jealousy. 2 days later, Marcellus fell sick. His symptoms were precisely the same as those of Augustus in his recent illness. So naturally, Musa was sent for again. He had become excessively rich and famous, charging as much as 1,000 gold pieces for a single professional visit.
One Mucinex.
And making a favor of it at that. In all cases where Cygnus had not taken too strong a hold in his patients, his mere name was enough to bring about an immediate cure. The credit went to the cold lotions and cold potions, the secret prescriptions for which he refused to communicate to anyone. Augustus's confidence in Musa's powers was so great that he made light of Marcellus's sickness, and the games continued. But somehow, in spite of the unremitting attention of Livia, and the very coldest lotions and potions that Musa could prescribe, Marcellus died. Again, in spite of the unremitting attention of Livia. The grief of both Octavia and Augustus was unbound, and the death was mourned as a public calamity. There were, however, a good many level-headed people who did not regret Marcellus's disappearance. There would certainly have been a civil war again between him and Agrippa if Augustus had died and he had not attempted to step into his place. Now Agrippa was the only possible successor. But this was reckoning without Livia, whose fixed intention it was, in the event of Augustus's death, now a pause. Claudius, you said that you would not mention Livia's motives, but only record her acts. That's our complaint. Whose fixed intention it was, in the event of Augustus's death, to continue ruling the empire through my uncle Tiberius, with my father in support. She would arrange for them to be adopted as Augustus's heirs. Marcellus's death left Julia free for Tiberius to marry, and all would have gone well with Livia's plans had there not been a dangerous outbreak of political unrest at Rome, the mob clamoring for a restoration of the Republic. When Livia tried to address them from the palace steps, they pelted her with rotten eggs and filth. Augustus happened to be away on a tour of the eastern provinces, in the company with Maecenas, who had reached Athens when the news arrived. Livia wrote shortly and in haste that the situation in the city could not be worse, and that Agrippa's help must be secured at any price. Augustus at once summoned Agrippa from Lesbos and begged him, for friendship's sake, to return with him to Rome and restore public confidence. But Agrippa had been nursing his grudge too long to be grateful for this summons.
We're not going
to
cue the boys are back in town?
Nope, not yet.
Shit.
Too much dignity. He had too much integrity.
Too much integrity. He ain't there smoking them pussy sticks. He's got that real Colorado weed. Integrity butt.
He stood on his dignity. In 3 years, Augustus had written him only 3 letters, and those in a hard official tone, and after Marcellus's death, should certainly have recalled him. Why should he help Augustus now? It was Livia, as a matter of fact, who had been responsible for this estrangement. She had miscalculated the political situation by dropping Agrippa too soon. She had even hinted to Augustus that Agrippa, though absent in Lesbos, knew more than most people about Marcellus's mysterious and fatal illness. Someone, she said, had told her that Agrippa, when he heard the news, had shown no surprise and considerable complacence.
People are saying this.
Yeah.
People are saying this. I'm not necessarily saying it, but people are saying it.
Yeah. Agrippa told Augustus that he had been so long away from Rome that he was out of touch with city politics and did not feel capable of undertaking what was asked of him. Augustus, fearing that Agrippa, if he went to Rome in his present mood, would be more inclined to put himself forward as a champion of popular liberties than to support the imperial government, dismissed him with words of gracious regret and hurriedly summoned Maecenas to ask his advice. Maecenas wanted permission to talk to Agrippa freely on Augustus's behalf and undertook to find out from him exactly on what terms he would do what and was intended of him.
So basically, come on, man, what do you want? Help us out here.
Yeah. On what terms he would do what was wanted of him. Augustus begged Maecenas, for God's sake, to do so, quote, as quick as boiled asparagus, a favorite expression of his.
Must roll off the tongue better in Latin.
In Latin? Yeah.
That's just
as quick as boiled asparagus.
That's pretty clunky.
So Maecenas took Agrippa aside and said, quote, now, old friend, what is it that you want? I realize that you think you have been badly treated, but I assure you that Augustus has a right to think himself equally injured by you. Can't you see how badly you behaved towards him by not being frank? It was an insult both to his justice and to his friendship for you. If you had explained that Marcellus's faction put you in a very uncomfortable position, and that Marcellus himself had insulted you, I swear to you that Augustus never knew about this until just the other day, he would have done all in his powers to right matters. My frank opinion is that you have behaved like a sulky child, and he has treated you like a father who won't be bullied by that sort of behavior. You say that he wrote you very cold letters. Were your own then written in such affectionate language? What sort of goodbye had you given him? I want to mediate between the two of you now, because if this breach continues, it will be the ruin of us all. You both love each other dearly. It is only right that the two greatest living Romans should. Augustus has told me that he is ready, as soon as you show your old openness to him, to renew the friendship on the same terms as before, or even more intimate ones, unquote. Agrippa, he said that? Maecenas, his very words. May I tell him how grieved you are that you offended him? May I explain that it was a misunderstanding? This is some good mediating, isn't it? Maecenas is not a dumb guy.
He's slimy. Come on, buddy, you should say this.
His very words. May I tell him how grieved you are that you offended him? And may I explain that it was a misunderstanding? That you left Rome thinking that he was aware of Marcellus's insult to you at the banquet? And that now you are anxious, on your side, to make up for past failures in friendship? And that you rely on him to meet you halfway? Agrippa said, Maecenas, you are a fine fellow and a true friend. Tell Augustus I am his to command as always. Maecenas said, I shall tell him that with the greatest pleasure, and I shall add, as my own opinion, that it would not be safe to send you back to the city now to restore order without some outstanding mark of personal confidence. Then Maecenas went to Augustus, quote, I smoothed him down nicely. He'll do anything you want. But he wants to believe that you really love him, like a child jealous of his father's love for another child. I think that the only thing that would really satisfy him would be for you to let him marry Julia. Of course, Livia had planned for Julia to marry Tiberius. Augustus had to think quickly. He remembered that Agrippa and his wife, who was Marcellus's sister, had been on bad terms ever since the quarrel with Marcellus, and that Agrippa was supposed to be in love with Julia. He wished Livia were present to advise him, but there was no escape from an instant decision. If he offended Agrippa now, he would never recover his support. Livia had written, quote, at any price, so he was free to make what arrangements he pleased. He sent for Agrippa again, and Maecenas staged a dignified scene of reconciliation. Augustus said that if Agrippa would consent to marry his daughter, it would be proof to him that the friendship which he valued before any other in the world was established on a secure foundation. Agrippa wept tears of joy and asked pardons for his shortcomings. He would try to be worthy of Augustus's loving generosity. Agrippa returned to Rome with Augustus and immediately divorced his wife and married Julia. The marriage was so popular and its celebration so magnificently lavish that the political disturbances immediately subsidedBC 21 is when this happened. Agrippa won great credit for Augustus, too, by carrying through the negotiations for the return of the Eagle Standards, which were formally handed over to Tiberius as Augustus's personal representative. The eagles were sacred objects, more truly sacred to Roman hearts than any marble statues of gods. A few captives returned too, but after 32 years of absence, they were hardly worth welcoming back. Most of them preferred to remain in Parthia, where they had settled down and married native women. My grandmother Livia was far from pleased with the bargain made with Agrippa, the only cheerful side of which was the dishonor done to Octavia by the divorce of her daughter. But she concealed her feelings. It was 9 years before Agrippa's services could be spared. Then he died suddenly at his country house. Curious. Augustus was away in Greece at the time, so there was no inquest on the body, in BC 12, by the way. Agrippa left a large number of children behind him, 3 boys and 2 girls, as Augustus's heirs at law. It would be difficult for Livia to set their claims aside in favor of her own sons. However, Tiberius then married Julia, who had made things easy for Livia by falling in love with him, and begging Augustus to use his influence with Tiberius on her behalf. Augustus consented only because Julia threatened suicide if he refused to help her. Tiberius himself hated having to marry Julia, but did not dare refuse.
This is the only thing I've ever heard that makes me believe in fate. It was Tiberius's it was just Tiberius's destiny to marry this woman he didn't want to. He thought he dodged a bullet for like 9 years.
Yeah.
I want to hear Tiberius's side of this story. What's he doing?
Tiberius himself hated having to marry Julia, but did not dare refuse. He was obliged to divorce his own wife, Vipsania, Agrippa's daughter by a former marriage, whom he passionately loved. And of course, Julia is literally his stepsister, because Julia is the daughter of Augustus, who's married to Tiberius's mother.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've seen something.
So I
pretty
mean,
sure I've seen something like this on Pornhub.
Tiberius himself hated having to marry his stepsister Julia, but he did not dare refuse. He was obliged to divorce his own wife, Vipsania, whom he passionately loved. Once when he met her accidentally, afterwards in the street, he followed her with his eyes in such a hopeless longing that Augustus, when he heard of it, gave orders that, for decency's sake, this must not happen again. Special lookouts must be kept by the officers of both households to avoid an encounter. Vipsania married, not long afterwards, an ambitious young noble called Gallus. And before I mention it, I must mention my father's marriage to my mother, Antonia, the younger daughter of Mark Antony and Octavia. It had taken place in the year of Augustus's illness and Marcellus's death. My uncle Tiberius was one of the bad Claudians. He was morose, reserved, and cruel, but there had been 3 people whose influence had checked these elements in his nature. First, there was my father, one of the best Claudians, cheerful, open, and generous. Next, there was Augustus, a very honest, merry, kindly man who disliked Tiberius but treated him generously for his mother's sake. And lastly, there was Vipsania, his former wife. My father's influence was removed, or lessened, when they were both of an age to do their military service and were sent on campaign to different parts of the empire. Then came the separation from Vipsania, and this was followed by a coolness with Augustus, who was offended by my uncle's ill-concealed distaste for Julia. With these three influences removed, he gradually went altogether to the bad. I should, at this point, I think, describe his personal appearance of Tiberius. He was a tall, dark-haired, fair-skinned, heavily built man, with a magnificent pair of shoulders, and hands so strong that he could crack a walnut or bore a tough-skinned green apple through with thumb and forefinger. If he had not been so slow in his movements, he would have been a champion boxer. He once killed a comrade in a friendly bout, bare-fisted, not with the usual metal boxing gloves, with a blow on the side of the head that cracked his skull. He walked with his neck thrust slightly forward and his eyes on the ground. His face would have been handsome if it had not been disfigured by so many pimples, and if his eyes had not been so prominent, and if he had not worn an almost perpetual frown.
That's a lot of ands.
His statues make him look extremely handsome because they leave out these defects. He spoke
Damn,
little
had airbrushing
and
back
with that
then?
Very slowly. Well, if you look up a picture of a statue of Tiberius, I gotta say, I feel like the bad parts of that description kind of come through. But I'll let the listeners do that on their own.
They made it. Apparently he looked even worse.
He spoke little, and that very slowly, so that in conversation with him, one always felt tempted to finish his sentences for him and answer them in the same breath. But when he pleased, he was an impressive public speaker. He went bald early in his life, except at the back of his head, where he grew his hair long, a fashion of ancient nobility.
Hell yeah.
He was never ill.
He had a ponytail.
Yeah, like a
big,
a mullet without
big,
the
powerful
rest.
Hands,
yeah.
A fucking mullet tail thing, and never got sick.
Yeah, yeah.
And some... some powerful shoulders.
Tiberius, unpopular as he was in Roman society, was nevertheless an extremely successful general. Now, this part I think is actually very interesting because it's going to get into like the differences in leadership styles and like effective leading is like done not just in one way. So I actually think that we might find some more stuff to talk about here, Jared. So I'm curious what you think about this. Unpopular as he was in Roman society, Tiberius was an extremely successful general. He revived various ancient disciplinary severities, but since he did not spare himself when on campaign, seldom sleeping in a tent, eating and drinking no better than the men, and always charging at their head in battle, they preferred to serve under him than under some good-humored, easygoing commander.
This dude is Andrew Jackson.
In whose leadership they did not have the same confidence. Tiberius never gave his men a smile or a word of praise, and often overmarched and overworked them. That's pure Andrew Jackson, dude.
Except for Andrew Jackson was a sickly, sickly man.
Yeah. Quote, "Let them hate me," he once said, "so long as they obey me." He kept the colonels and regimental officers in as strict order as the men, so there were no complaints of his partiality. Service under Tiberius was not unprofitable. He usually contrived to capture and sack the enemy's camps and cities. He fought successful wars in Armenia, Parthia, Germany, Spain, Dalmatia, the Alps, and France.
This guy is Bill Belichick. Except for they, it sounds like they actually pay their guys.
My father was, as I say, one of the best Claudians. He was as strong as his brother, far better looking, quicker of speech and movement, and by no means less successful as a general. He treated all soldiers as Roman citizens, and therefore as his equals, except in rank and education. He hated having to inflict punishment on them. He gave orders that, as far as possible, all offenses against discipline should be dealt with by the offender's own comrades, whom he assumed to be jealous for the good name of their section or company. He gave it out that if they found that any offense was beyond their corrective powers, for he did not allow them to kill a culprit or incapacitate him from his daily military duties, it should be referred to the regimental colonel. But so far as possible, he wished his men to be their own judges. The captains might flog by permission of their regimental colonels, but only in cases where the offense, such as cowardice in battle or theft from a comrade, showed a baseness of character that made flogging appropriate. But he ordered that a man once flogged must never afterwards serve as a combatant. He must be degraded to the transport or clerical staff. Any soldier who considered that he had been unjustly sentenced by his comrades or his captains might appeal to him, but he thought it unlikely that such sentences would need to be revised.
So they whip you and then they take your gun and your badge and you're on desk duty now?
Yeah. Like, if you've been whipped once, you're never going to be in a line of combat again. But you can see the reasoning for that, I mean, right? Yeah. Like,
can't be stealing from the boys. We're not going to suffer a coward out there.
Yeah, and this person is untrustworthy, right? You don't want them by you in the line. Any soldier who considered that he had been unjustly treated might appeal. This system worked admirably because my father was such a fine soldier that he inspired the troops to a virtue of which other commanders did not believe them capable. But it can be understood how dangerous it was for troops who had been handled in this way to be commanded afterwards by an ordinary general. The gift of independence, once granted, cannot be lightly taken away again. There was always trouble when troops who had served under my father happened to be drafted for service under my uncle. It happened the other way about, too. Troops who had served under my uncle reacted with scorn and suspicion to my father's disciplinary system. Their custom had been to shield each other's crimes and to pride themselves on their cunning in avoiding detection. And since under my uncle, a man could be flogged, for example, for addressing an officer without first being addressed, or for speaking with too great a frankness, or for behaving independently in any way, it was an honor rather than a disgrace for a soldier to be able to show the marks of the lash on his back. So what do you think of these two leadership styles between Tiberius and Claudius Drusus?
I mean, definitely give me Claudius.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that a little bit more than just like the, although I will say, you know, give me one or the other, but don't give me anywhere in between. Like I feel like I can function in an authoritarian system where the leadership is like, you know, held to the same standard as the lowest rung, right? It's not fun, but if there's like a shared expectation, you know, bearing lashes as a sign of pride, right? Like, I get that, you know, but if there's like, you can't wishy-wash though. That's why, like he's saying, you can't go back and forth, you know? I don't know. What do you think?
I think I'll take the one without the lashes.
Yeah. The trial by your peers.
I mean,
right?
Yeah, it seems like it's a lot more difficult to fuck up, but you know, you still can.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think that's very interesting, that kind of comparison that we're presented with there. All right. My father's greatest victories were in the Alps, France, the Low Countries, but especially in Germany, where his name will, I think, never be forgotten. He was always in the thick of the fighting. His ambition was to perform a feat which had only been performed twice in Roman history, namely, as general, to kill the opposing general with his own hands and strip him of his
arms. Holy shit.
He was many times very close to success, but his prey always escaped him.
What the hell? Is this like a Dragon Ball Z episode here?
Totally, yeah. Either the fellow galloped off the field or surrendered instead of fighting, or some officious private soldier got the blow in first. Veterans telling me stories of my father have often chuckled admirably. Oh, sir, it used to do our hearts good to see your father on his black horse playing hide and seek in the battle with one of those German chieftains. He'd be forced to cut down 9 or 10 of the bodyguard sometimes, tough men too, before he got near the standard, and by then the wily bird would be flown. The proudest boast of men who had served under my father was that he was the first Roman general who had marched the full length of the Rhine from Switzerland to the North Sea. All right, and that's the end of chapter 3. And I need to go take my dog on a walk. So we're going to save chapter 4 for next time.
Sounds like a deal.
But yes, we've got Livia getting active with her poisons, busting out the herbarium divinorum a little bit there, right?
I'm just picturing her as Lucille from Arrested Development.
Get rid of the C word.
I'll leave when I'm good and ready.
Yeah, totally.
R.I.P. to Mrs. Walters.
Well, the Arrested Development thing is a funny comparison, because one thing I'm a fan of the original run of the show, which is of course set against the backdrop of America's imperial expansion in Iraq, making it even more apropos. But Arrested Development is all about incest, right? And what we see in this family is that there's a lot of that as well, you know. So I think that's
a dangerous cousins journey. Back in Rome too.
Yeah, le cousin dangereux. Yeah, Tiberius would be a dangerous cousin. Yeah. But yeah, it's funny to go back to the leadership thing. Because I've worked as a teacher, Jared, right?
I've seen it once or twice.
I've taught both ways. I've taught under a regime where I gave my students, like, a lot of say over how their grading and like the structure of their performance would go. And then I've been an absolute stickler as well. And I don't know. The only trouble I've ever had is when I've tried to, and not because of maybe a shortcoming myself, but I've had a group of students who, like, if you just give them plenty of leash, all they do is hang themselves. And then it's really hard to get back into like a stricter mode of expectation. So
this was more talking about like discipline though, right? Not everything. Yeah, they weren't discipline, like coming up with their own strategy and shit, were they?
No. But I don't know. I think that little comparison there is just interesting. Yeah.
For sure, but the people you were like teaching, they weren't like killing people together and sleeping together and like, you know.
Right. No. But I just think that, you know, what Claudius is getting at here is a real kind of like, I guess I would say a real material difference in leadership that can inspire maybe even like similar loyalty kind of
interest. Oh, sure. I mean, and it really makes sense once you have like a little taste of like having some rights going back to the other way. Fuck that, man.
Yeah. No way. Yeah. Yeah. I would go with either, yeah. But
then if you come from the other one, you probably think you're surrounded by a bunch of sissies that are going to get you killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Nobody here.
And it's interesting.
Nobody here's been whipped once. I was whipped 4 times and I deserved it, and it made me better.
Uh, It's also wild that these guys were brothers.
Oh yeah. You know?
Which I guess kind of speaks to like just the importance of like a single individual's like outlook, even on historical processes, you know? Well, all right. So with that, next time, we're going to learn a little bit more about Claudius Drusus and Claudius's brother, Germanicus, who has a pretty cool name, you know?
Wait, is that a name or a title?
Yeah. It was a title granted to Claudius's father shortly after his death in Germany, and which was passed on and inherited by Claudius's brother, who we mainly know as Germanicus. Okay, so
turned into a name from a title.
Yeah, and that's pretty common amongst these Romans. Because, of course, if we fast forward a few centuries, you know, the name Caesar and the name Augustus are going to both become titles in the Tetrarchy under Diocletian, mm-hmm. when you actually have four Roman emperors running the empire. So the start of a trend there, right?
For sure.
Any other Rome thoughts before we wrap up, Jared?
I don't know. It's just, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, happy Catalans Aprilis. You know, it's good that we did our little like fake start because it is April Fool's Day,
of course. Right?
Which I think you said is a very Roman holiday when mm-hmm. you think about it.
First day of the month, best day of the month.
Very much. Hell yeah. And yeah, plants are starting to pop up. I'm seeing some blooms.
Yep.
Spring is coming.
The shit, what's that stuff called? The garlic mustard is coming up out in the woods here.
Oh yeah.
It's that time.
Yep.
Found a couple of mushrooms the other day and
what kind of mushrooms are you finding already?
Well, there were like some like shelf mushrooms. I don't really get too carried away with identifying those because they're inedible. But
okay.
Then I found some those Scarlet Elf cups that I've mentioned before. So they usually come up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. Those are edible.
Yeah,
right?
They are. They just don't really taste very good.
Oh, okay.
In my opinion. You can do better. Sure.
Right on.
But, yeah, I'm just excited for things to start warming up and, yeah, plants to start growing and reproducing. And
hell yeah.
Things going on outside.
Well, let's both get out there. Let's get out there and enjoy Apollo's blessing while we still can. And may Jupiter Capitolinus bring good tidings to all of our listeners out there in podcast land.
Hear, hear. Well, mostly the virtuous ones, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Not those perfidious, unvirtuous ones.
Well, I mean, it's, you know.
Plotting against...
Maybe not every other day, but today we can make an exception.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for listening. We've been the Compost Bin of History. You can find us on Patreon, the Poor Brotherhood of Composters.
And
with that...
We wish glory onto you and all your pursuits.
Awe, true to Kaisar. Buon dia.
Means a nationalist, imperialist, totalitarian, homogenous culture that obliterates the identity of every group it conquers. Long-term stability at all cost. The individual has no value beyond his utility to the state, whether as an instrument of war or production. No. I'll destroy it because it's inevitable that it be destroyed. It's Hegelian dialectics, not personal animosity. How do I put this basically enough? It's a philosophical theory, the kind you might encounter if you took time to read some books. The fundamental premise is to envision history as a sequence of dialectical conflicts. Each dialectic begins with a proposition, a thesis, which inherently contains or creates its opposite, an antithesis. Thesis and antithesis. The conflict is inevitable, but the resolution of the conflict yields something new, a synthesis, eliminating the flaws in each, leaving behind common elements.